Asquith sent a letter this morning to Douglas. Maud presumed he meant General Sir Charles Douglas, chief of the Imperial General Staff. Our Prime Minister wanted to put it on record that the government had never promised to send British troops to France in the event of a war with Germany. Maud, as the only Liberal present, felt obliged to defend the government. But it's true, Fitz. Asquith is only making it clear that all our options are open. Then what on earth was the point of all the talks we've held with the French military? To explore possibilities, to make contingency plans. Talks are not contracts, especially in international politics. Friends are friends. Britain is a world leader. A woman doesn't necessarily understand these things, but people expect us to stand by our neighbours. As gentlemen, we abhor the least hint of deceit, and we should do the same as a country. That was the kind of talk that might yet get Britain embroiled in a war, Maud thought with a shiver of panic. She just could not get her brother to understand the danger. Their love for one another had always been stronger than their political differences, but now they were so angry that they might quarrel gravely. And when Fitz fell out with someone, he never made it up. Yet he was the one who would have to fight, and perhaps die, shot or bayoneted or blown to pieces. Fitz, and Walter too. Why could Fitz not see that? It made her want to scream. While she struggled to find adequate words, one of the other guests spoke. Maud recognized him as the foreign editor of the Times, a man called Steed. I can tell you that there is a dirty German-Jewish international financial attempt to bully my paper into advocating neutrality, he said. The Duchess pursed her lips. She disliked the language of the gutter press. What makes you say so? Maud said coldly to Steed. Lord Rothschild spoke to our financial editor yesterday, the journalist said. Wants us to moderate the anti-German tone of our articles in the interests of peace. Maud knew Natty Rothschild, who was a liberal. She said, And what does Lord Northcliffe think of Rothschild's request? Northcliffe was the proprietor of the Times. Steed grinned. He ordered us to print an even stiffer leading article today. He picked up a copy of the paper from a side table and waved it. Peace is not our strongest interest, he quoted. Maud could not think of anything more contemptible than deliberately encouraging war. She could see that even Fitz was disgusted by the journalist's frivolous attitude. She was about to say something when Fitz, with his unfailing courtesy, even to brutes, changed the subject. I've just seen the French ambassador, Paul Cambon, coming out of the Foreign Office, he said. He was as white as that tablecloth. He said, Ils vont nous lâcher. They're going to let us down. He had been with Grey. The Duchess asked, Do you know what Grey had said to upset Monsieur Cambon so? Yes, Cambon told me. Apparently the Germans are willing to leave France alone if France promises to stay out of the war, and if the French refuse that offer, the British will not feel obliged to help defend France. Maud felt sorry for the French ambassador, but her heart leaped with hope at the suggestion that Britain might stay out of the war. But France must refuse that offer, the Duchess said. She has a treaty with Russia, according to which each must come to the other's aid in war. Exactly, said Fitz angrily. What is the point of international alliances if they are to be broken at the moment of crisis? Nonsense, Maud said, knowing she was being rude but not caring. International alliances are broken whenever convenient. That isn't the issue. And what is, pray? Fitz said frostily. I think Asquith and Grey are simply trying to frighten the French with a dose of reality. France cannot defeat Germany without our help. If they think they might have to go it alone, perhaps the French will become peacemakers and pressure their Russian allies to back off from war with Germany. And what about Serbia? Maud said, Even at this stage, it's not too late for Russia and Austria to sit down at a table and work out a solution for the Balkans that both can live with. There was a silence that lasted for a few seconds. Then Fitz said, I doubt very much that anything like that will happen. But surely, said Maud, and even as she spoke she could hear the desperation in her own voice, surely we must keep hope alive. 4. Maud sat in her room and could not summon the energy to change her clothes for dinner. Her maid had laid out a gown and some jewellery, but Maud just stared at them. She went to parties almost every night during the London season, because much of the politics and diplomacy that fascinated her was done at social occasions. But tonight she felt she could not do it, could not be glamorous and charming, could not entice powerful men to tell her what they were thinking, could not play the game of changing their minds without their even suspecting that they were being persuaded. Walter was going to war. He would put on a uniform and carry a gun, and enemy troops would fire shells and mortars and machine gun rounds at him and try to kill him, or wound him so badly that he was no longer able to stand up. She found it hard to think about anything else, and she was constantly on the edge of tears. She had even had harsh words with her beloved brother. There was a tap at the door. Grout stood outside.
"Herr von Ulrich is here, my lady," he said.
Maud was shocked. She had not been expecting Walter. Why had he come? Noticing her surprise, Grout added, "When I said my master was not at home, he asked for you."
"Thank you," said Maud,
and she pushed past Grout and headed down the stairs. Grout called after her, "Herr von Ulrich is in the drawing room. I will ask Lady Hermia to join you." Even Grout knew that Maud was not supposed to be left alone with a young man, but Aunt Herm did not move fast, and it would be several minutes before she arrived. Maud rushed into the drawing room and threw herself into Walter's arms.
"What are we going to do?" she wailed. "Walter, what are we going to do?"
He hugged her hard, then gazed at her gravely. His face was grey and drawn. He looked as if he had been told of a death. He said, "France has not replied to the German ultimatum."
"Have they said nothing at all?" she cried.
"Our ambassador in Paris insisted on a response. The message from Premier Viviani was, 'France will have regard to her own interests. They will not promise neutrality.'
But there may still be time."
"No. They have decided to mobilize. Joffre won the argument, as the military have in every country. The telegrams were sent at 4 o'clock this afternoon, Paris time."
"There must be something you can do. Germany has run out of choices,"
he said. "We cannot fight Russia with a hostile France at our backs, armed and eager to win back Alsace-Lorraine. So we must attack France. The Schlieffen plan has already been set in motion. In Berlin, the crowds are singing the Kaiser hymn in the streets."
"You'll have to join your regiment,"
she said, and she could not hold back the tears.
"Of course."
She wiped her face. Her handkerchief was too small, a stupid scrap of embroidered lawn. She used her sleeve instead.
"When?"
she said.
"When will you have to leave London?"
"Not for a few days." He was fighting back tears himself, she saw. He said, "Is there any chance at all that Britain can be kept out of the war? Then at least I wouldn't be fighting against your country."
"I don't know," she said.
"Tomorrow will tell." She pulled him close.
"Please hold me tight."
She rested her head on his shoulders and closed her eyes. 5. Fitz was angered to see an anti-war demonstration in Trafalgar Square on Sunday afternoon. Keir Hardie, the Labour MP, was speaking, dressed in a tweed suit, like a gamekeeper, Fitz thought. He stood on the plinth of Nelson's Column, shouting hoarsely in his Scots accent, desecrating the memory of the hero who died for Britain at the Battle of Trafalgar. Hardie said that the coming war would be the greatest catastrophe the world had ever seen. He represented a mining constituency, Merthyr, near Aberowen. He was the illegitimate son of a maidservant, and had been a coal miner until he went into politics. What did he know about war? Fitz stalked off in disgust and went to the Duchess's for tea. In the Grand Hall he came upon Maud, deep in conversation with Walter. The crisis was driving him away from both of them, to his profound regret. He loved his sister and he was fond of Walter. But Maud was a liberal and Walter a German, and in times like these it was hard even to speak to them. However, he did his best to seem amiable, as he said to Maud, "I hear this morning's cabinet was stormy." She nodded.
"Churchill mobilized the fleet last night without asking anyone. John Burns resigned this morning in protest."
"I can't pretend to be sorry." Burns was an old radical, the most fervently anti-war cabinet minister. "So the rest must have endorsed Winston's action."
"Reluctantly."
"We must be grateful for small mercies." It was appalling, Fitz felt, that at this time of national danger, the government should be in the hands of these leftist ditherers. Maud said, "But they refused Grey's request for a commitment to defend France." "Still acting like cowards, then," Fitz said. He knew he was being rude to his sister, but he felt too bitter to hold back.
"Not quite," Maud said evenly.
"They agreed to prevent the German navy passing through the English Channel to attack France." Fitz brightened a little.
Well, that's something. Walter put in, the German government has responded by saying we have no intention of sending ships into the English Channel. Fritz said to Maud, you see what happens when you stand firm.
Don't be so smug, Fritz, she said.
If we do go to war, it will be because people such as you have not tried hard enough to prevent it.
Oh, really?
He was offended. Well, let me tell you something. I spoke to Sir Edward Grey last night at Brooks's club. He has asked both the French and the Germans to respect the neutrality of Belgium. The French agreed immediately. Fritz looked challengingly at Walter. The Germans have not responded.
It's true.
Walter gave an apologetic shrug. My dear Fritz, you, as a soldier, will see that we couldn't answer that question, one way or the other, without giving away our war plans. I do see, but in the light of that, I want to know why my sister thinks I am a warmonger and you are a peacemaker. Maud avoided the question. Lloyd George thinks Britain should intervene only if the German army violates Belgian territory substantially. He may suggest it at tonight's cabinet. Fitz knew what that meant. Furiously, he said, so we will give Germany permission to attack France via the southern corner of Belgium?
I suppose that is exactly what it means.
I knew it, Fitz said. The traitors, they're planning to wriggle out of their duty. They will do anything to avoid war.
I wish you were right, said Maud.
6. Maud had to go to the House of Commons on Monday afternoon to hear Sir Edward Grey address members of Parliament. The speech would be a turning point. Everyone agreed. Aunt Herm went with her. For once, Maud was glad of an old lady's reassuring company. Maud's fate would be decided this afternoon, as well as the fate of thousands of men of fighting age. Depending on what Grey said and how Parliament reacted, women all over Europe could become widows, their children orphans. Maud had stopped being angry, worn out with it, perhaps. Now she was just frightened. War or peace, marriage or loneliness, life or death, her destiny. It was a holiday, so the city's huge population of bank clerks, civil servants, lawyers, stockbrokers and merchants all had the day off. Most of them seemed to have gathered near the great departments of government in Westminster, hoping to be the first to hear news. The chauffeur steered Fitz's 7-passenger Cadillac limousine slowly through the vast crowds in Trafalgar Square, Whitehall, and Parliament Square. The weather was cloudy but warm, and the more fashionable young men wore straw boaters. Maud glimpsed a placard for the Evening Standard that read, On the Brink of Catastrophe. The crowd cheered as the car drew up outside the Palace of Westminster. Then there was a little groan of disappointment when it disgorged nothing more interesting than two ladies. The onlookers wanted to see their heroes, men such as Lloyd George and Keir Hardie. The palace epitomized the Victorian mania for decoration, Maud thought. The stone was elaborately carved, there was linen fold panelling everywhere, the floor tiles were multicoloured, the glass was stained, and the carpets were patterned. Although it was a holiday, the house was sitting, and the place was crowded with members and peers, most of them in the parliamentary uniform of black morning coat and black silk top hat. Only the Labour members defied the dress code by wearing tweeds or lounge suits. The peace faction was still a majority in cabinet, Maud knew. Lloyd George had won his point last night, and the government would stand aside if Germany committed a merely technical violation of Belgian territory. Helpfully, the Italians had declared neutrality, saying their treaty with Austria obliged them to join only in a defensive war, whereas Austria's action in Serbia was clearly aggressive. So far, Maud thought, Italy was the only country to have shown common sense. Fitz and Walter were waiting in the octagonal central lobby. Maud immediately said, I haven't heard what happened at this morning's cabinet. Have you?
3 more resignations, Fitz said. Morley, Simon and Beecham. All 3 were anti-war. Maud was discouraged and also puzzled.
Not Lloyd George?
No.
Strange.
Maud felt a chill of foreboding. Was there a split in the peace faction?
What is Lloyd George up to?
Walter said, I don't know, but I can guess. He looked solemn. Last night, Germany demanded free passage through Belgium for our troops. Maud gasped. Walter went on, The Belgian cabinet sat from 9 o'clock yesterday evening until 4 this morning, then rejected the demand and said they would fight. This was dreadful. Fitz said, So Lloyd George was wrong. The German army is not going to commit a merely technical violation. Walter said nothing, but spread his hands in a gesture of helplessness.
Maud feared that the brutal German ultimatum and the Belgian government's foolhardy defiance might have undermined the peace faction in the cabinet. Belgium and Germany looked too much like David and Goliath. Lloyd George had a nose for public opinion. Had he sensed that the mood was about to change? "We must take our places," said Fitz. Full of apprehension, Maud passed through a small door and climbed a long staircase to emerge in the Strangers' Gallery, overlooking the chamber of the House of Commons. Here sat the sovereign government of the British Empire. In this room, matters of life and death were decided for the 444 million people who lived under some form of British rule. Every time she came here, Maud was struck by how small it was, with less room than the average London church. Government and opposition faced each other on tiered rows of benches, separated by a gap that, according to legend, was two sword lengths, so that opponents could not fight. For most debates, the chamber was almost empty, with no more than a dozen or so members sprawled comfortably on the green leather upholstery. Today, however, the benches were packed, and MPs who could not find seats were standing at the entrance. Only the front rows were vacant, those places being reserved by tradition for cabinet ministers on the government side, and opposition leaders on the other. It was significant, Maud thought, that today's debate was to take place in this chamber, not in the House of Lords. In fact, many of the peers were, like Fitz, here in the gallery, watching. The House of Commons had the authority that came from being elected by the people, even though not much more than half of adult men had the vote, and no women. Much of Asquith's time as Prime Minister had been spent fighting the Lords, especially over Lloyd George's plan to give all old people a small pension. The battles had been fierce, but each time the Commons had won. The underlying reason, Maud believed, was that the English aristocracy were terrified that the French Revolution would be repeated here, so in the end they always accepted a compromise. The front benches came in, and Maud was immediately struck by the atmosphere among the Liberals. The Prime Minister, Asquith, was smiling at something said by the Quaker, Joseph Peace, and Lloyd George was talking to Sir Edward Grey. "Oh, God," Maud muttered. Walter, sitting next to her, said, "What? Look at them," she said. "They're all pals together. They've made up their differences." "You can't tell that just by looking."
"Yes, I can."
The speaker entered in an old-fashioned wig and sat on the raised throne. He called on the Foreign Secretary, and Grey stood up, his gaunt face pale and careworn. He had no skill as a speaker. He was wordy and ponderous. Nevertheless, the members squeezed along the benches, and the visitors in the packed gallery listened in attentive silence, waiting patiently for the important part. He spoke for 3/4 of an hour before mentioning Belgium. Then, at last, he revealed the details of the German ultimatum that Walter had told Maud about an hour earlier. The MPs were electrified. Maud saw that, as she had feared, this changed everything. Both sides of the Liberal Party, the right-wing imperialists and the left-wing defenders of the rights of small nations, were outraged. Grey quoted Gladstone, asking whether, under the circumstances of the case, this country, endowed as it is with influence and power, would quietly stand by and witness the perpetration of the direst crime that ever stained the pages of history, and thus become participators in the sin. This was rubbish, Maud thought. An invasion of Belgium would not be the direst crime in history. What about the Corn Poor Massacre? What about the slave trade? Britain did not intervene every time a country was invaded. It was ludicrous to say that such inaction made the British people participants in the sin. But few present saw things her way. Members on both sides cheered. Maud stared in consternation at the government front bench. All the ministers who had been fervently against war yesterday were now nodding agreement. Young Herbert Samuel, Louis Lulu Harcourt, the Quaker Joseph Peace, who was president of the Peace Society, and worst of all, Lloyd George himself. The fact that Lloyd George was supporting Grey meant that the political battle was over, Maud realized in despair. The German threat to Belgium had united the opposing factions. Grey could not play on his audience's emotions, as Lloyd George did, nor could he sound like an Old Testament prophet, as Churchill did. But today he did not need such skills, Maud reflected. The facts were doing all the work. She turned to Walter and said in a fierce whisper, "Why? Why has Germany done this?" His face twisted in an agonized expression, but he answered with his usual calm logic.
South of Belgium, the border between Germany and France is heavily fortified. If we attacked there, we would win, but it would take too long. Russia would have time to mobilize and attack us from behind. The only way for us to be sure of a quick victory is to go through Belgium. But it also ensures that Britain will go to war against you.
Walter nodded.
But the British army is small. You rely on your navy, and this is not a sea war. Our generals think Britain will make little difference. Do you agree? I believe it's never smart to make an enemy of a rich and powerful neighbor. But I lost that argument.
And that was what had happened repeatedly over the last 2 weeks, Maud thought despairingly. In every country, those who were against war had been overruled. The Austrians had attacked Serbia when they might have held back. The Russians had mobilized instead of negotiating. The Germans had refused to attend an international conference to settle the issue. The French had been offered the chance to remain neutral and had spurned it. And now the British were about to join in, when they might easily have remained on the sidelines. Grey had reached his peroration. I have put the vital facts before the House. And if, as seems not improbable, we are forced, and rapidly forced, to take our stand upon these issues, then I believe, when the country realizes what is at stake, what the real issues are, the magnitude of the impending dangers in the west of Europe, which I have endeavored to describe to the House, we shall be supported throughout, not only by the House of Commons, but by the determination, the resolution, the courage, and the endurance of the whole country. He sat down to cheers from all sides. There had been no vote, and Grey had not even proposed anything, but it was clear from the reaction that the MPs were ready for war. The leader of the opposition, Andrew Bonner Law, got up to say that the government could rely on the support of the Conservatives. Maud was not surprised. They were always more warlike than the Liberals. But she was amazed, as was everyone else, when the Irish nationalist leader said the same thing. Maud felt as if she was living in a madhouse. Was she the only person in the world who wanted peace? Only the Labour Party leader dissented.
I think he is wrong, said Ramsay MacDonald, speaking of Grey. I think the government, which he represents, and for which he speaks, is wrong. I think the verdict of history will be that they are wrong.
But no one was listening. Some MPs were already leaving the chamber. The gallery was also emptying. Fitz stood up, and the rest of his group followed suit. Maud went along listlessly. Down in the chamber, MacDonald was saying,
If the Right Honourable Gentleman had come here today and told us that our country is in danger, I do not care what party he appealed to, or to what class he appealed, we would be with him. What is the use of talking about coming to the aid of Belgium when, as a matter of fact, you are engaging in a whole European war?
Maud passed out of the gallery and heard no more. This was the worst day of her life. Her country was going to fight an unnecessary war. Her brother and the man she loved were going to risk their lives, and she was going to be separated from her fiancé, perhaps forever. All hope was lost, and she was in total despair. They went down the stairs, Fitz leading the way.
Most interesting, Fitz, dear, said Aunt Herm politely, as if she had been taken to an art exhibition that had turned out better than expected.
Walter grasped Maud's arm and held her back. She let three or four other people get ahead of them, so that Fitz was out of earshot. But she was not prepared for what came next.
Marry me,
Walter said quietly. Her heart raced.
What?
She whispered.
How? Marry me, please. Tomorrow. It can't be done. I have a special license.
He tapped the breast pocket of his coat. I went to Chelsea Register Office on Friday. Her mind was in a whirl. All she could think of to say was,
We agreed to wait.
As soon as it was out, she wanted to take it back. But he was already speaking.
We have waited. The crisis is over. Your country and mine will be at war tomorrow or the day after. I will have to leave Britain. I want to marry you before I go.
We don't know what's going to happen, she said.
Indeed we don't. But however the future turns out, I want you to be my wife.
But... Maud stopped speaking. Why was she voicing objections? He was right. No one knew what was going to happen, but that made no difference now. She wanted to be his wife, and no future that she could imagine would change that. Before she could say more, they reached the foot of the stairs and emerged into the central lobby, where a crowd was abuzz with excited conversation. Maud desperately wanted to ask Walter more questions,
but Fitz gallantly insisted on escorting her and Aunt Herm out because of the crowds. In Parliament Square, Fitz handed the two women into the car. The chauffeur activated the automatic crank, the engine rumbled, and the car pulled smoothly away, leaving Fitz and Walter standing on the pavement, with a crowd of bystanders waiting to hear their fate. 7. Maud wanted to be Walter's wife. It was the only thing she was sure of. She held on to that thought while questions and speculations buzzed around her head. Should she fall in with Walter's plan, or would it be better to wait? If she agreed to marry him tomorrow, whom would she tell? Where would they go after the ceremony? Would they live together? If so, where? That evening before dinner, her maid brought her an envelope on a silver tray. It contained a single sheet of heavy cream-colored paper, covered with Walter's precise, upright handwriting in blue ink. 6:00 p.m. My dearest love, at 3:30 tomorrow, I will wait for you in a car across the road from Fitz's house. I will bring with me the requisite 2 witnesses. The registrar is booked for 4:00. I have a suite at the Hyde Hotel. I have checked in already, so that we can go to our room without delaying in the lobby. We are to be Mr. and Mrs. Woolridge. Wear a veil. I love you, Maud. Your betrothed. W. With a shaky hand, she put the sheet of paper down on the polished mahogany top of her dressing table. Her breath was coming fast. She stared at the floral wallpaper and tried to think calmly. He had chosen the time well. Mid-afternoon was a quiet moment when Maud might be able to slip out of the house unnoticed. Aunt Herm took a nap after lunch, and Fitz would be at the House of Lords. Fitz must not know in advance, for he would try to stop her. He might simply lock her in her room. He could even get her committed to a lunatic asylum. A wealthy, upper-class man could have a female relative put away without much difficulty. All Fitz would have to do was to find 2 doctors willing to agree with him that she must be mad to want to marry a German. She would not tell anyone. The false name and the veil indicated that Walter meant to be clandestine. The Hyde was a discreet hotel in Knightsbridge, where they were unlikely to meet anyone they knew. She shivered with a thrill of anticipation when she thought of spending the night with Walter. But what would they do the next day? A marriage could not be secret forever. Walter would be leaving Britain in 2 or 3 days. Would she go with him? She was afraid she would blight his career. How could he be trusted to fight for his country if he was married to an Englishwoman? And if he did fight, he would be away from home. So what was the point of her going to Germany? Despite all the unknowns, she was full of delicious excitement. "Mrs. Woolridge," she said to the bedroom, and she hugged herself with joy. 11. August 4th, 1914. At sunrise, Maud got up and sat at her dressing table to write a letter. She had a stack of Fitz's blue paper in her drawer, and the silver inkwell was filled every day. "My darling," she began. Then she stopped to think. She caught sight of herself in the oval mirror. Her hair was tousled and her nightdress rumpled. A frown creased her forehead and turned down the corners of her mouth. She picked a fragment of some green vegetable from between her teeth. "If he could see me now," she thought, "he might not want to marry me." Then she realized that if she went along with his plan, he would see her exactly like this tomorrow morning. It was a strange thought, scary and thrilling at the same time. She wrote, "Yes, with all my heart, I want to marry you. But what is your plan? Where would we live?" She had been thinking about this half the night. The obstacles seemed immense. "If you stay in Britain, they will put you in a prison camp. If we go to Germany, I will never see you because you will be away from home with the army. Their relatives might create more trouble than the authorities. When are we to tell our families about the marriage? Not beforehand, please, because Fitz will find a way to stop us. Even afterwards, there will be difficulties with him and with your father. Tell me what you are thinking. I love you dearly." She sealed the envelope and addressed it to his flat, which was 1/4 mile away. She rang the bell, and a few minutes later, her maid tapped on the door. Sanderson was a plump girl with a big smile. Maud said, "If Mr. Ulrich is out, go to the German embassy in Carlton House Terrace. Either way, wait for his reply. Is that clear?"
"Yes, my lady."
"No need to tell any of the other servants what you're doing." A worried look came over Sanderson's young face. Many maids were party to their mistress's intrigues, but Maud had never had secret romances, and Sanderson was not used to deception.
"What shall I say when Mr. Gratt asks me where I'm going?"
Maud thought for a moment.
"Tell him you have to buy me certain feminine articles."
Embarrassment would curb Grout's curiosity.
"Yes, my lady."
Sanderson left, and Maud got dressed. She was not sure how she was going to maintain a semblance of normality in front of her family. Fitz might not notice her mood, men rarely did, but Aunt Herm was not completely oblivious. She went downstairs at breakfast time, although she was too tense to feel hungry. Aunt Herm was eating a kipper, and the smell made Maud feel rather ill. She sipped coffee. Fitz appeared a minute later. He took a kipper from the sideboard and opened the Times.
"What do I normally do?" Maud asked herself.
"I talk about politics."
"Then I must do that now. Did anything happen last night?"
she said. "I saw Winston after Cabinet," Fitz replied. "We are asking the German government to withdraw its ultimatum to Belgium." He gave a contemptuous emphasis to the word asking. Maud did not dare to feel hope.
"Does that mean we have not completely given up working for peace?"
"We might as well," he said scornfully. "Whatever the Germans may be thinking, they're not likely to change their minds because of a polite request.
A drowning man may clutch at a straw."
"We're not clutching at straws. We're going through the ritual preliminaries to a declaration of war." He was right, she thought dismally. All governments would want to say that they had not wanted war, but had been forced into it. Fitz showed no awareness of the danger to himself, no sign that this diplomatic fencing might result in a mortal wound to himself. She longed to protect him, and at the same time she wanted to strangle him for his foolish obstinacy. To distract herself, she looked through the Manchester Guardian. It contained a full-page advertisement placed by the Neutrality League, with the slogan, "Britons, do your duty and keep your country out of a wicked and stupid war." Maud was glad to know there were still people who thought as she did, but they had no chance of prevailing. Sanderson came in with an envelope on a silver tray. With a shock, Maud recognized Walter's handwriting. She was aghast. What was the maid thinking of? Did she not realize that if the original note was a secret, the reply must be too? She could not read Walter's note in front of Fitz. Heart racing, she took it with pretended carelessness and dropped it beside her plate, then asked Grout for more coffee. She looked at her newspaper to hide her panic. Fitz did not censor her mail, but as the head of the family, he had the right to read any letter addressed to a female relative living in his house. No respectable woman would object. She had to finish breakfast as fast as possible and take the note away unopened. She tried to eat a piece of toast, forcing the crumbs down her dry throat. Fitz looked up from the Times. "Aren't you going to read your letter?" he said, and then, to her horror, he added, "That looks like von Ulrich's handwriting." She had no choice. She slipped the envelope with a clean butter knife and tried to fix her face in a neutral expression. 9 o'clock a.m. "My dear love, all of us at the embassy have been told to pack our bags, pay our bills, and be ready to leave Britain at a few hours' notice. You and I should tell no one of our plan. After tonight, I will return to Germany, and you will remain here, living with your brother. Everyone agrees this war cannot last more than a few weeks, or at most, months. As soon as it is over, if we are both still alive, we will tell the world our happy tidings and start our new life together. And in case we do not survive the war, oh, please, let us have one night of happiness as husband and wife. I love you. W. P.S. Germany invaded Belgium an hour ago." Maud's mind was in a whirl. Married secretly. No one would know. Walter's superiors would still trust him, not knowing about his marriage to an enemy. And he could fight, as his honor demanded, and even work in secret intelligence. Men would continue to court Maud, thinking her single. But she could deal with that. She had been giving suitors the brush off for years. They would live apart until the end of the war, which would come in a few months at most. Fitz interrupted her thoughts. "What does he say?" Maud's mind went blank. She could not tell Fitz any of this. How was she to answer his question? She looked down at the sheet of heavy, cream-colored paper and the upright handwriting, and her eye fell on the P.S. "He says Germany invaded Belgium at 8 o'clock this morning." Fitz put down his fork. "That's it, then." For once, even he looked shocked. Aunt Herm said, "Little Belgium, I think those Germans are the most frightful bullies. Then she looked confused and said, except Herr von Ulrich, of course. He's charming.
Fitz said, so much for the British government's polite request.
It's madness, said Maud desolately. Thousands of men are going to be killed in a war no one wants.
I should have thought you might have supported the war,
Fitz said argumentatively. After all, we will be defending France, which is the only other real democracy in Europe, and our enemies will be Germany and Austria, whose elected parliaments are virtually powerless.
But our ally will be Russia, Maud said bitterly, so we will be fighting to preserve the most brutal and backward monarchy in Europe.
I see your point. Everyone at the embassy has been told to pack, she said. We may not see Walter again.
She casually put the letter down. It did not work.
Fitz said, may I see?
Maud froze. She could not possibly show it to him. Not only would he lock her up, if he read the sentence about one night of happiness, he might take a gun and shoot Walter.
May I? Fitz repeated, holding out his hand.
Of course, she said. She hesitated another second, then reached for the letter. At the last moment she was inspired, and she knocked over her cup, spilling coffee on the sheet of paper.
Oh, dash it, she said, noting with relief that the coffee had caused the blue ink to run, and the words had already become illegible.
Grout stepped forward and began to clear up the mess. Pretending to be helpful, Maud picked up the letter and folded it, ensuring that any writing that might so far have escaped the coffee was now soaked.
I'm sorry, Fitz, she said, but in fact, there was no further information.
Never mind, he said, and went back to his newspaper. Maud put her hands in her lap to hide their shaking. 2. That was only the beginning. It was going to be difficult for Maud to get out of the house alone. Like all upper-class ladies, she was not supposed to go anywhere unescorted. Men pretended this was because they were so concerned to protect their women, but in truth it was a means of control. No doubt it would remain until women won the vote. Maud had spent half her life finding ways to flout this rule. She would have to sneak out without being seen. This was quite difficult. Although only 4 family members lived in Fitz's Mayfair mansion, there were at least 12 servants in the house at any time. And then she had to stay out all night without anyone's knowledge. She put her plan into place carefully.
I have a headache, she said at the end of lunch. Bear, will you forgive me if I don't come down to dinner tonight?
Of course, said Bear. Is there anything I can do? Shall I send for Professor Rathbun?
No, thank you. It's nothing serious.
A headache that was not serious was the usual euphemism for a menstrual period, and everyone accepted this without further comment. So far, so good. She went up to her room and rang for her maid.
I'm going to bed, Sanderson, she said, beginning a speech she had worked out carefully. I'll probably stay there for the rest of the day. Please tell the other servants that I'm not to be disturbed for any reason. I may ring for a dinner tray, but I doubt it. I feel as if I could sleep the clock round.
That should ensure that her absence was not noticed for the rest of the day.
Are you sick, my lady?
Sanderson asked, looking concerned. Some ladies took to their beds frequently, but it was rare for Maud.
It's the normal female affliction, just worse than usual.
Sanderson did not believe her, Maud could tell. Already today the maid had been sent out with a secret message, something that had never happened before. Sanderson knew something unusual was going on, but maids were not permitted to cross-examine their mistresses. Sanderson would just have to wonder.
And don't wake me in the morning, Maud added.
She did not know what time she would get back, or how she would sneak unobserved into the house. Sanderson left. It was 3:15. Maud undressed quickly, then looked in her wardrobe. She was not used to getting her own clothes out. Normally Sanderson did it. Her black walking dress had a hat with a veil, but she could not wear black for her wedding. She looked at the clock above the fireplace. 3:20. There was no time to dither. She chose a stylish French outfit. She put on a tight-fitting white lace blouse with a high collar to emphasize her long neck. Over it she wore a dress of a sky blue so pale it was almost white. In the latest daring fashion, it ended an inch or two above her ankles. She added a broad-brimmed straw hat in dark blue with a veil the same color, and a gay blue parasol with a white lining.
She had a blue velvet drawstring bag that matched the outfit. Into it she put a comb, a small vial of perfume, and a clean pair of drawers. The clock struck 3:30. Walter would be outside now, waiting. She felt her heart beating hard. She pulled down the veil and examined herself in a full-length mirror. It was not quite a wedding dress, but it would look just right, she imagined, in a register office. She had never been to a civil wedding, so she was not sure. She took the key from the lock and stood by the closed door, listening. She did not want to meet anyone who might question her. It might not matter if she was seen by a footman or a bootboy, who would not care what she did, but all the maids would know by now that she was supposed to be unwell, and if she ran into one of the family, her deception would be exposed instantly. She hardly cared about the embarrassment, but she was afraid they would try to stop her. She was about to open the door when she heard heavy footsteps and caught a whiff of smoke. It must be Fitz, still finishing his after-lunch cigar, leaving for the House of Lords or perhaps White's Club. She waited impatiently. After a few moments of silence, she looked out. The broad corridor was deserted. She stepped out, closed the door, locked it, and dropped the key into her velvet bag. Now anyone trying the door would assume she was asleep inside. She walked silently along the carpeted corridor to the top of the stairs and looked down. There was no one in the hall below. She went quickly down the steps. As she reached the half-landing, she heard a noise and froze. The door to the basement swung open, and Grout emerged. Maud held her breath. She looked down at the bald dome of Grout's head as he crossed the hall carrying 2 decanters of port. He had his back to the stairs, and he entered the dining room without looking up. As the door closed behind him, she ran down the last flight, throwing caution to the wind. She opened the front door, stepped out, and slammed it behind her. Too late, she wished she had thought to close it quietly. The quiet Mayfair street baked in the August sun. She looked up and down and saw a horse-drawn fishmonger's cart, a nanny with a perambulator, and a cabbie changing the wheel of a motor taxi. 100 yards along, on the opposite side of the road, stood a white car with a blue canvas canopy. Maud liked cars, and she recognized this as a Benz 1030, belonging to Walter's cousin Robert. As she crossed the road, Walter got out, and her heart filled with joy. He was wearing a light grey morning suit with a white carnation. He met her eye, and she saw, from his expression, that until this moment he had not been sure she would come. The thought brought a tear to her eye. Now, though, his face lit up with delight. How strange and wonderful it was, she thought, to be able to bring such happiness to another person. She glanced anxiously back to the house. Grout was in the doorway, looking up and down the road with a puzzled frown. He had heard the door slam, she guessed. She turned her face resolutely forward, and the thought that came into her head was, free at last. Walter kissed her hand. She wanted to kiss him properly, but her veil was in the way. Besides, it was inappropriate before the wedding. There was no need to throw all the proprieties out of the window. Robert was at the wheel, she saw. He touched his grey top hat to her. Walter trusted him. He would be one of the witnesses. Walter opened the door and Maud got into the back seat. Someone was already there, and Maud recognized the housekeeper from T. Gwen. "Williams!" she cried. Williams smiled. "You'd better call me Ethel now," she said. "I'm to be a witness at your wedding." "Of course. I'm sorry." Impulsively, Maud hugged her. "Thank you for coming." The car pulled away. Maud leaned forward and spoke to Walter. "How did you find Ethel?" "You told me she had come to your clinic. I got her address from Dr. Greenwood. I knew you trusted her because you chose her to chaperone us at T. Gwen." Ethel handed Maud a small posy of flowers. "Your bouquet." They were roses, coral pink, the flower of passion. Did Walter know the language of flowers? "Who chose them?" "It was my suggestion," said Ethel, "and Walter liked it when I explained the meaning." Ethel blushed. Ethel knew how passionate they were, because she had seen them kiss, Maud realized. "They're perfect," she said. Ethel was wearing a pale pink dress that looked new, and a hat decorated with more pink roses. Walter must have paid for that. How thoughtful he was. They drove down Park Lane and headed for Chelsea. "I'm getting married," Maud thought. In the past, Whenever she had imagined her wedding, she had assumed it would be like those of all her friends, a long day of tedious ceremony. This was a better way to do things. There had been no planning, no guest list, and no caterer. There would be no hymns, no speeches, and no drunk relations trying to kiss her. Just the bride and groom and two people they liked and trusted. She thrust from her mind all thoughts about the future. Europe was at war, and anything might happen. She was just going to enjoy the day and night. They drove down King's Road, and suddenly she felt nervous. She took Ethel's hand for courage. She had a nightmare vision of Fitz following behind in his Cadillac, shouting, "Stop that woman!" She glanced back. Of course, neither Fitz nor his car was in sight. They pulled up outside the classical facade of the Chelsea Town Hall. Robert took Maud's arm and led her up the steps to the entrance, and Walter followed with Ethel. Passers-by stopped to watch. Everyone loved a wedding. Inside, the building was extravagantly decorated in the Victorian manner, with coloured floor tiles and plaster mouldings on the walls. It felt like the right sort of place to get married. They had to wait in the lobby. Another wedding had taken place at 3:30 and had not yet finished. The four of them stood in a little circle, and no one could think of anything to say. Maud inhaled the scent of her roses, and the perfume went to her head, making her feel as if she had gulped a glass of champagne. After a few minutes, the earlier wedding party emerged, the bride wearing an everyday dress and the groom in the uniform of an army sergeant. Perhaps they too had made a sudden decision because of the war. Maud and her party went in. The registrar sat at a plain table, wearing a morning coat and a silver tie. He had a carnation in his buttonhole, which was a nice touch, Maud thought. Beside him was a clerk in a lounge suit. They gave their names as Mr. von Ulrich and Miss Maud Fitzherbert. Maud raised her veil. The registrar said, "Miss Fitzherbert, can you provide evidence of identity?" She did not know what he was talking about. Seeing her blank look, he said, "Your birth certificate, perhaps?" She did not have her birth certificate. She had not known it was required, and even if she had, she would not have been able to get hold of it, for Fitz kept it in the safe, along with other family documents such as his will. Panic seized her. Then Walter said, "I think this will serve." He took from his pocket a stamped and franked envelope addressed to Miss Maud Fitzherbert at the street address of the baby clinic. He must have picked it up when he went to see Dr. Greenwood. How clever of him. The registrar handed the envelope back without comment. He said, "It is my duty to remind you of the solemn and binding nature of the vows you are about to take." Maud felt mildly offended at the suggestion that she might not know what she was doing. Then she realized that was something he had to say to everyone. Walter stood more upright. "This is it," Maud thought. "No turning back." She felt quite sure she wanted to marry Walter, but more than that, she was acutely aware that she had reached the age of 23 without meeting anyone else she would remotely have considered as a husband. Every other man she had ever met had treated her, and all women, like overgrown children. Only Walter was different. It was him or no one. The registrar was speaking words for Walter to repeat. "I do solemnly declare that I know not of any lawful impediment why I, Walter von Ulrich, may not be joined in matrimony to Maud Elizabeth Fitzherbert." Walter pronounced his own name the English way, Walter, rather than the correct German, Walter. Maud watched his face as he spoke. His voice was firm and clear. In his turn, he watched her solemnly as she made her declaration. She loved his seriousness. Most men, even quite clever ones, became silly when they talked to women. Walter spoke to her just as intelligently as he spoke to Robert or Fitz, and, even more unusually, he listened to her answers. Next came the vows. Walter looked her in the eye as he took her for his wife, and this time she heard a little shake of emotion in his voice. That was the other thing she loved. She knew she could undermine his seriousness. She could make him tremble with love or happiness or desire. She made the same vow. "I call upon these persons here present to witness that I, Maud Elizabeth Fitzherbert, do take thee, Walter von Ulrich, to be my lawful wedded husband." There was no unsteadiness in her voice, and she felt a little embarrassed that she was not visibly moved, but that was not her style. She She preferred to appear cool even when she was not. Walter understood that, and he, more than anyone, knew about the storms of unseen passion that blew through her heart. "Do you have a ring?" said the registrar. Maud had not even thought about it, but Walter had. He drew a plain gold wedding band from his waistcoat pocket, took her hand, and slipped it onto her finger. He must have guessed the size, but it was a near fit, perhaps just one size too big. As their marriage was to be secret, she would not be wearing it for a while after today. "I now pronounce you man and wife," said the registrar. "You may kiss the bride." Walter kissed her lips softly. She put her arm around his waist and drew him closer. "I love you," she whispered. The registrar said, "And now for the marriage certificate. Perhaps you would like to sit down, Mrs. Ulrich." Walter smiled. Robert giggled, and Ethel gave a little cheer. Maud guessed the registrar enjoyed being the first person to call the bride by her married name. They all sat down, and the registrar's clerk began to fill out the certificate. Walter gave his father's occupation as army officer and his place of birth as Danzig. Maud put her father down as George Fitzherbert, farmer. There was, in fact, a small flock of sheep at Tŷ Gwen, so the description was not actually false, and her place of birth as London. Robert and Ethel signed as witnesses. Suddenly it was over, and they were walking out of the room and through the lobby, where another pretty bride was waiting with a nervous groom to make a lifelong commitment. As they walked arm in arm down the steps to the car parked at the curb, Ethel threw a handful of confetti over them. Among the bystanders, Maud noticed a middle-class woman of her own age carrying a parcel from a shop. The woman looked hard at Walter, then turned her gaze on Maud. And what Maud saw in her eyes was envy. "Yes," Maud thought, "I'm a lucky girl." Walter and Maud sat in the back of the car, and Robert and Ethel rode up front. As they drove away, Walter took Maud's hand and kissed it. They looked into one another's eyes and laughed. Maud had seen couples do that, and had always thought it was stupid and sentimental, but now it seemed the most natural thing in the world. In a few minutes they arrived at the Hyde Hotel. Maud dropped her veil. Walter took her arm and they walked through the lobby to the stairs. Robert said, "I'll order the champagne." Walter had taken the best suite and filled it with flowers. There must have been 100 coral pink roses. Tears came to Maud's eyes, and Ethel gasped in awe. On a sideboard was a big bowl of fruit and a box of chocolates. The afternoon sun shone through large windows onto chairs and sofas upholstered in gay fabrics. "Let's make ourselves comfortable," Walter said jovially. While Maud and Ethel were inspecting the suite, Robert came in, followed by a waiter with champagne and glasses on a tray. Walter popped the cork and poured. When they each had a glass, Robert said, "I would like to propose a toast." He cleared his throat, and Maud realized with amusement that he was going to make a speech. "My cousin, Walter, is an unusual man," he began. "He has always seemed older than me, although in fact we are the same age. When we were students together in Vienna, he never got drunk. If a group of us went out in the evening to visit certain houses in the city, he would stay home and study. I thought perhaps he was the type of man who does not love women." Robert gave a wry smile. "In fact, it was I who was made that way, but that's another story, as the English say. Walter loves his family and his work, and he loves Germany. But he has never loved a woman. Until now. He has changed." Robert grinned mischievously. "He buys new ties. He asks me questions. When do you kiss a girl? Should men wear cologne? What colors flatter him? As if I knew anything about what women like. And most terrible of all, in my view." Robert paused dramatically. "He plays ragtime." The others laughed. Robert raised his glass. "Let us toast the woman who has wrought such changes, the bride." They drank, and then, to Maud's surprise, Ethel spoke. "It falls to me to propose the toast to the groom," she said, as if she had been making speeches all her life. How had a servant from Wales acquired such confidence? Then Maud remembered that her father was a preacher and a political activist, so she had an example to follow. "Lady Maud is different from every other woman of her class I have ever met," Ethel said. "When I started working as a maid at Tŷ Gwen, she was the only member of the family who even noticed me. Here in London, when young unmarried women have babies, most respectable ladies grumble about moral decay, but Maud offers them real practical help. In the East End of London, she is regarded as a saint. However, she has her faults, and they are grave. Maud thought, what now? She is too serious to attract a normal man, Ethel went on. All the most eligible men in London have been drawn to her by her striking good looks and vivacious personality, only to be frightened away by her brains and her tough political realism. Some time ago I realized it would take a rare man to win her. He would have to be clever but open-minded, strictly moral but not orthodox, strong but not domineering. Ethel smiled. I thought it was impossible. And then, January, he came up the hill from Aberowen in the station taxi and walked into Tŷ Gwyn, and the wait was over. She raised her glass. To the groom. They all drank again. Then Ethel took Robert's arm. Now you can take me to the Ritz for dinner, Robert, she said. Walter seemed surprised. I assumed we would all have dinner together here, he said. Ethel gave him an arch look. Don't be daft, man, she said. She walked to the door, drawing Robert with her. Good night, Robert said, though it was only 6 o'clock. The two of them went out and closed the door. Maud laughed. Walter said, That housekeeper is extremely intelligent. She understands me, Maud said. She went to the door and turned the key. Now, she said, the bedroom. Would you prefer to undress in private? Walter said, looking worried. Not really, Maud said. Wouldn't you like to watch? He swallowed, and when he spoke he sounded a little hoarse. Yes, please, he said. I would. He held the bedroom door open and she passed through. Despite her show of boldness, she felt nervous as she sat on the edge of the bed and took off her shoes. No one had seen her naked since she was 8 years old. She did not know whether her body was beautiful because she had never seen anyone else's. By comparison with the nudes in museums, she had small breasts and wide hips, and there was a growth of hair between her legs that paintings never showed. Would Walter think her body was ugly? He took off his coat and waistcoat and hung them up in a matter-of-fact way. She supposed they would get used to this one day. Everyone did it all the time. But somehow it felt strange, more intimidating than exciting. She pulled down her stockings and took off her hat. She had nothing else superfluous. The next step was the big one. She stood up. Walter stopped undoing his tie. Quickly, Maud unfastened her dress and let it fall to the floor. Then she dropped her petticoat and pulled her lace blouse over her head. She stood in front of him in her underwear and watched his face. You are so beautiful, he said in a half whisper. She smiled. He always said the right thing. He took her in his arms and kissed her. She began to feel less nervous, almost relaxed. She savored the touch of his mouth on hers, the gentle lips and the bristles of the mustache. She stroked his cheek, squeezed his earlobe between her fingertips, and ran her hand around the column of his neck, feeling everything with heightened awareness, thinking, all this is mine now. Let's lie down, he said. No, she said. Not yet. She stepped away from him. Wait. She took off her chemise, revealing that she was wearing one of the newfangled brassieres. She reached behind her back, unfastened the clasp, and threw it to the floor. She looked at him defiantly, daring him not to like her breasts. He said, They are beautiful. May I kiss them? You may do anything you like, she said, feeling deliciously wanton. He bent his head to her chest and kissed one, then the other, letting his lips brush delicately across her nipples, which stood up suddenly as if the air had turned cold. She had a sudden yearn to do the same to him, and wondered if he would think it odd. He might have kissed her breasts forever. She pushed him away gently. Take off the rest of your clothes, she said, quickly. He pulled off shoes, socks, tie, shirt, undershirt, and trousers. Then he hesitated. I feel shy, he said, laughing. I don't know why. I'll go first, she said. She untied the string of her drawers and pulled them off. When she looked up, he was naked too, and she saw with a shock that his penis was sticking up from the thatch of fair hair at his groin. She remembered grasping it through his clothes at the opera, and now she wanted to touch it again. He said, May we now lie down?
He sounded so correct that she laughed. A hurt look crossed his face, and she was immediately apologetic.
I love you, she said, and his expression cleared. Please, let us lie down.
She was so excited she felt she might burst. At first they lay side by side, kissing and touching.
I love you,
she said again. How soon will you get bored with my saying that?
Never,
he said gallantly. She believed him. And after a while he said,
Now?
And she nodded. She parted her legs. He lay on top of her, resting his weight on his elbows. She was taut with anticipation. Shifting his weight to his left arm, he reached between her thighs, and she felt his fingers opening her moist lips, then something larger. He pushed, and suddenly she felt a pain. She cried out,
I'm sorry, he said. I hurt you. I'm so terribly sorry. Just wait a moment, she said.
The pain was not very bad. She was more shocked than anything else.
Try again, she said, just gently.
She felt the head of his penis touch her lips again, and she knew that it would not go inside. It was too big, or the hole was too small, or both. But she let him push, hoping for the best. It hurt, but this time she gritted her teeth and stopped herself crying out. Her stoicism did no good. After a few moments he stopped.
It won't go in, he said. What's wrong?
She said miserably.
I thought this was supposed to happen naturally. I don't understand it, he said. I have no experience.
And I certainly have none. She reached down and grasped his penis. She loved the feel of it in her hand, stiff but silky. She tried to maneuver it inside her, raising her hips to make it easier. But after a moment he pulled away, saying,
Ah, sorry, it hurts me too.
Do you think you're bigger than usual? She said tentatively.
No.
When I was in the army, I saw many men naked. Some fellows have extra large ones, and they are very proud, but I am average, and anyway, I never heard even one of them complain of this difficulty.
Maud nodded.
The only other penis she had ever seen was Fitz's, and as far as she could remember it was about the same size as Walter's.
Perhaps I'm too small.
He shook his head. When I was 16, I went to stay in Robert's family castle in Hungary. There was a maid there, Greta, who was very vivacious. We did not have sexual intercourse, but we did experiment. I touched her the way I touched you in the library at Sussex House. I hope I am not making you angry by telling you this. She kissed his chin. Not in the least. Greta was not very different from you in that area.
Then what is wrong?
He sighed and rolled off her. He put his arm under her head and pulled her to him, kissing her forehead. I have heard that newly married couples may have difficulties. Sometimes the man is so nervous that he does not become erect. I've also heard of men who become overexcited and ejaculate even before intercourse takes place. I think we must be patient and love one another and see what happens.
But we have only one night,
Maud began to cry. Walter patted her and said,
There, there.
But it did no good. She felt a complete failure. I believed I was so clever, she thought, escaping from my brother and marrying Walter secretly, and now it has all turned into a disaster. She was disappointed for herself, but even more for Walter. How terrible for him to wait until the age of 28, then marry a woman who could not satisfy him. She wished she could talk to someone about this, another woman. But who? The thought of discussing it with Aunt Herme was ludicrous. Some women shared secrets with their maids, but Maud had never had that kind of relationship with Sanderson. Perhaps she could talk to Ethel. Now that she came to think of it, it was Ethel who had told her it was normal to have hair between your legs, but Ethel had gone off with Robert. Walter sat upright. Let us order supper and perhaps a bottle of wine, he said. We will sit down together as man and wife and talk of this and that for a while. Then later we will try again. Maud had no appetite and could not imagine having a conversation about this and that, but she did not have a better idea, so she consented. Miserably, she put her clothes back on. Walter dressed quickly, went to the next room, and rang the bell for a waiter. She heard him ordering cold meats, smoked fish, salads, and a bottle of hock. She sat by an open window and looked down at the street below. A newspaper placard said, British ultimatum to Germany. Walter might be killed in this war. She did not want him to die a virgin. Walter called her when the food had arrived, and she joined him in the next room. The waiter had spread a white cloth and laid out smoked salmon, sliced ham, lettuce, tomatoes, cucumber, and sliced white bread. She did not feel hungry, but sipped the white wine he poured, and nibbled some salmon to show she was willing. In the end, they did talk of this and that. Walter reminisced about his childhood, his mother, and his time at Eton. Maud spoke about house parties at Tŷ Gwyn, when her father was alive. The most powerful men in the land were guests, and her mother would have to arrange the allocation of bedrooms so that men could be near their mistresses. At first, Maud found herself consciously making conversation, as if they were two people who hardly knew one another. But soon they relaxed into their normal intimacy, and she just said whatever came into her mind. The waiter cleared away the supper, and they moved to the couch, where they continued to talk, holding hands. They speculated about other people's sex lives. Their parents, Fitz, Robert, Ethel, even the Duchess. Maud was fascinated to learn about men such as Robert, where they met, how they recognized one another and what they did. They kissed each other just as men kissed women, Walter told her, and they did what she had done to him at the opera, and other things. He said he was not sure of the details, but she thought he did know and just felt embarrassed to say. She was surprised when the clock on the mantelpiece struck midnight. "Let's go to bed," she said. "I want to lie in your arms, even if things don't happen the way they're supposed to." "All right." He stood up. "Do you mind if I do something first? There is a telephone in the lobby for the use of guests. I'd like to phone the embassy." "Of course." He went out. Maud went to the bathroom along the corridor, then returned to the suite. She took off her clothes and got into bed naked. She almost felt she did not care what happened now. They loved one another and they were together, and if that was all, it would be enough. Walter returned a few minutes later. His face was grim, and she knew immediately that the news was bad. "Britain has declared war on Germany," he said. "Oh, Walter, I'm so sorry." The note was received at the embassy an hour ago. Young Nicholson brought it round from the Foreign Office and got Prince Lichnowsky out of bed. They had known it was almost certain to happen, but even so the reality struck Maud like a blow. She could see that Walter was upset too. He took off his clothes automatically, as if he had been undressing in front of her for years. "We leave tomorrow," he said. He took off his underpants, and she saw that his penis, in its normal state, was small and wrinkled. "I must be at Liverpool Street Station with my bags packed by 10 o'clock. He turned off the electric light and got into bed with her. They lay side by side, not touching, and for an awful moment Maud thought he was going to go to sleep like that. Then he turned to her and took her in his arms and kissed her mouth. Despite everything, she was flooded with desire for him. Indeed, it was almost as if their troubles had made her love him more urgently and desperately. She felt his penis grow and harden against her soft belly. After a moment, he got on top of her. As before, he leaned on his left arm and touched her with his right hand. As before, she felt the hard penis pressing her lips. As before, it hurt, but only for a moment. This time it slipped inside her. There was another moment of resistance. Then she lost her virginity. And suddenly he was all the way in.